With all the stories that matter across the Northwest, it's Greg Hughes on the 9 to Noon Show on Highland Radio.
And you are very welcome back to the programme. Good morning if you've just joined us. It is 9 minutes past 10 on this Thursday, the 25th of May, 2023. Coming up soon, we're going to be having a chat to Senator Eileen Flynn, I suppose, just reflecting on her career and, I suppose, balancing that career and family life and dealing with the... the pressures that come with public office. Any questions or comments, by the way, get involved in that conversation, 086 60 25,000, or give us a call on 07491 25,000. I would like to mention that there's a coffee morning taking place in the station house at Letterkenny this morning between 11 a.m. and 12 noon, and it's to raise funds for Irish guide dogs. So if you wish to get along to that and have a nice cup of coffee and support that, please do. And I also want to mention a tractor run that is coming up. It's in aid of TJ's Wish to Walk on Bank Holiday, Sunday the 4th of June. It's a great day guaranteed. The tractor run starts and finishes at Rosie's Bar. That's in Drumkeen, of course. Registration is from 1:30 p.m. and there's a raffle and refreshments afterwards. So that's a tractor run on that bank holiday Sunday, June 4th. A great day guaranteed, and you will be supporting little TJ's Wish to Walk. Okay, right, so that's those two things mentioned. Hi, Greg. They say there is no money about. Try and book a hotel any weekend in Ireland and see what you'll pay for a hotel room. It's unreal. There are plenty. There's plenty of money around. Yeah, there is plenty of money. But in any economy like ours, you'll have people who are very well off, people who are poor, very poor. And then you get people in the middle who are sort of ticking along to some extent. So there'll always be people with money. I was chatting to someone not so long ago who was charged and actually paid, believe it or not, €450 for a hotel on the weekend of the rugby final and Katie Taylor's fight. €450. I just couldn't. Someone earlier on, remember we were talking about wine, called me tight. I must be tight. I certainly wouldn't pay that amount of money. Right, okay. I'm going to take this break now, and I'm going to get to your calls and comments coming in as the morning progresses, but we're going to be joined by Senator Eileen Flynn. So stay right where you are. Okay, you're very welcome back to the programme. It is the 9 till noon show here in Highland Radio. Hi, Greg. I work as a home help support in Letterkenny. Just wanting to give a big shout out to a group of people, non-Irish, they say, who I see every Sunday morning doing litter cleanup in the Old Town and O'Donnell Park area. They do a great job, worth acknowledging. Thank you. No problem. Non-competitive games for all sports is always the way forward. The streamlining of children on ability that is judged by so-called elite coaches should not be acceptable. Every child develops at different ages, and the biggest example is the 11+. Sport is for enjoyment, and in a lot of cases, the least talented of your children go on to be the best volunteers within any sport club. The elite players never seem to come back and help their former clubs. Maybe the case being they've lost the love of the sport. Always remember, children are the most important part of any sports club. As Bruce Springsteen says, nobody wins unless everyone wins. Okay, let's see if I can say hello now to our next guest, and that is Senator Eileen Flynn. Hello, Senator, can you hear me?
Hi, Greg, how are you?
I'm good. It's good to have you on the show. How are you keeping?
I'm really good. Sorry, I'm just moving from one place to another. Just the committee. Really good. Thanks for having me on the show this morning to speak about being in politics and being a mother as well.
Yeah, no, it's good to have you on. And you settle yourself there, Eileen, obviously in a busy environment. And we'll just wait for that mobile signal to settle there. All right, let's see what our connection's like. Okay, so Eileen, tell us a little bit of, about yourself, as much as you're comfortable to talk to us about just your life maybe before politics.
Yes, before politics, I was living in Ballyfermot before I got married as well, obviously. I was always an activist and well involved in human rights and equality in Ireland, and involved in many campaigns. So that was really my life before I moved to Donegal and got involved in politics. And when I got involved, Billy, my oldest little girl, was 5 months old when I campaigned and lobbied for the seat that I have now. And I got in when she was 9 months old, actually. And it's just been, sometimes it gets very overwhelming because, you know, you're trying to balance out the home life with the political life as well. And I am a full-time mother, but unfortunately, I only get to spend half the week with my kids and the other half then in work. So I stay in Donegal 4 nights a week and in Dublin 3 nights a week. And actually, this is a really tough week because I'm in Cork tomorrow, speaking about women in an election. And I think there's many barriers that face women in general and even women without kids, obviously, entering into politics. But from my own experience as a mother, again, overwhelming, you know, like you feel a lot of your time feeling sorry that you can't be there with your kids. And then you do look at the brighter future that you're trying to make for your children too. But that doesn't mean that it's easy. Now, I know for Lacey and Billy, when I left Monday evening, actually, because Lacey's getting a little bit older now, she's a year and a half, and the two of them just sobbed, crying, you know. And that's really tough because, again, you feel that you're only, obviously, you're only there half the time with them and you don't want your kids to be feeling rejected. You don't want your kids to be feeling abandoned either, you know. So for me personally, I don't know what it's like for other women. That's where I'm at. And then
I presume it's I presume it's a constant emotional battle in that, you know, you have that maternal pull, right? But then you sort of try and make yourself feel a bit better, as we all have to, because you sort of say, well, I have to also look at the bigger picture. But I presume one emotion is always competing with the other. You don't leave in a Monday and then everything's all right till you get back. I mean, it's a tough one. None of us like to leave our children for any extended period of time.
And then I do think there's different roles that men and women take on in the house as well, you know. Like when I go home on the Thursday, it's the cleaning, it's the washing, it's the preparing for the following week ahead, making sure there's food. And while men are brilliant and try their very best, you know, I think a lot of it is left to women really to make sure that everything is done. So
we could be getting into dangerous territory here, so we'll be careful, Eileen. Okay. But there is no way. There's no doubt in most cases. There's a man cleaned house, and then sometimes the other half can come around and do the proper job. I think a lot of people out there might sort of relate to that.
Yeah, to be fair to Liam, I often walked in on a wet floor on a Thursday evening, and you know it's brilliant. He's really good. To be fair to him, what I will say, from even talking to other politicians when they did it going back when their kids were younger, it would be similar experience, and it's the same for women who are nurses, who are doctors, who are in professions as well, that 8-to-8 job or the job having to leave the kids, like, you know, you still have the chores that other women, a lot of women would do anyway. And again, I just find it, as you said, emotionally tough. You have to, I know in my case, I organised the childcare. I organised that, like, you know, and again, I know Liam could do it if I wasn't there, but sometimes we put that pressure on ourselves as well.
Mm-hmm. And listen, I mean, obviously, and I hate to use sort of particular terms that separate us all out, but I have to sort of, for the purpose of this question, often, and we'll get to it, but often when we might speak to you or we hear from you, you're advocating for the traveller community, and it might be the treatment from the settled community towards you or the traveller community, and then we get sort of then that argument that happens within it. But I'm just curious as to how you feel that you're perceived by the traveller community. You know what I mean? Because your life is very different to that of what people might perceive to be, if you know what I mean, in terms of you working in politics is what I'm saying. You know, you've moved out of Dublin and spend much of your time in Donegal. So how are you, or do you have a sense of how you're viewed by fellow members of the traveller community?
Okay. You have 200 members in Leinster House, and I'm the only one that's a member of the traveller community. And for the other 200, over the other 200, they get to share out the responsibility. They're not all held accountable for the actions of settled people. And in my case, you know, I'm held accountable for over 40,000 people. And I also have to be very realistic that travellers have that are interested in politics and have their own views and the political system and in politics in general. And obviously, I don't speak in for every single member of the community. To be fair to Donegal Travellers and to the likes of David Friel, Hugh and Anne, they're really good support in Donegal and at a national level as well. And I have great support from traveller activists at a national level. But I will say, Greg, I do an awful lot of work with the traveller community, with people with disabilities, try me best with in Donegal and Ardra, where I live as well, migrants and refugees also. And really, you know, it's sometimes it can get very very much because you're trying to tackle as many issues as you can in any week or in any day that presents, you know.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, as the sort of soul, I mean, mothers might say that they've made representations, but as the sort of what would be seen as the sole voice of the traveller community in the Oireachtas, it's difficult when you raise an issue, specifically if it's a traveller-specific issue, because then you have the whataboutery that begins, okay? And it's really... Yes. So, in other words, you recently talked about... you recently talked about your experience of trying to get a taxi to a halting site, and then it started, yeah, but what about what might have happened to that taxi driver in the past, or what about pizza delivery companies not going into them, or what about the time I drove past one and something happened? Do you ever feel that you are going to struggle to make progress? Because it's almost, you're like a lightning rod for anti-traveller sentiment to some extent. So when you speak up trying to benefit the community, it almost actually brings more anti-traveller sentiment out. Does that make, do you get where I'm coming from? I wouldn't like to find myself in that position because I'd be afraid to speak.
But, you know, like, again, like, you can be targeted because of what you're trying to do as well. Like, I remember a few months ago, I said things were getting worse for refugees. And people came after me. It wasn't because of my language or the word I used. It was really because of the issue. And you were saying that Worcester isn't in the English dictionary, you know. And that's fine with me. But I got attacked because of using that word. And I think many politicians get attacked for their political views, whatever. But for me, it's always will be live and let live, no matter what your gender is, your community is, your way of life. Once you're not hurting another human being, and to a certain extent, like, I don't care, I don't go around thinking all day, about trans people. I don't go around thinking all day about people, black and brown people, people of colour. Do you know, I want to get up and live my life as well, but I don't want anyone to hurt people because of their identity. And maybe that's because I know how it feels to be hurt, to be rejected because of my identity, because of who I am as a person. So you do have all those layers. Like, I'm nearly 3 years into Shannon's. And if I sat on my hands for 3 years and did absolutely nothing, you know, I was the change. I made change. I'm part of the change. But, you know, I'm a very active person, politician. And I, as I said, I try my best. At the moment, I'm working with Sinn, can I get every local authority park in the country to have swings and facilities for children of special needs. In Ardra, my own community, I'm trying to get in exercise equipment around the park. And, you know, so you're trying to be everything to every community as well. And I absolutely love my job. I'm privileged to have the job. And the girls are getting a little bit older now, which is, you know, they're a little bit more independent. And Billy is off nappies. She's doing brilliant. Lacey, I've got a little way to go with them, you know. And the hardest part of the job for me is actually leaving the kids. I'm in Cork, as I said, tomorrow. And there's an event in Cork tomorrow at 1 o'clock with young people. And because they heard you were down, and it was around diversity, that's an extra layer of pressure because I've been invited to it. Now, I want to go because I haven't been in Cork in 3 years. But again, so I get home from Cork, to get the train to Cork, to Dublin, then back to Donegal. It'll be late tomorrow night, and I have to make that journey back because I told my child I'd be home Friday, and that's where the abandonment come from. Where if you tell them you'll be home a day and you're not home the following day, you know. So, like, again, I've made some good changes in here that I don't ever get the opportunities to speak about, like the bill. The bill that I brought forward January of 2022 to change the wording of child pornography to child sexual abuse by materials, and I'm hoping that bill will go to a second stage in the Dáil after the recess. And you know, change takes time, and I'd like to think that I'm not just a one trick pony, that like while traveller inequalities is at the heart of what I do. And yeah, you're right, as soon as I write up about it, as soon as I tweet about it, I get attacked left, right and centre. But I will say one thing, it's okay, because at the end of the day, you're still educating people, and some people can't be educated. Some people are always going to be racist, are always going to try and put other people down. And that's the sad world that we live in. So we have to keep trying to raise above that and keep going as from my case, as an activist, as a mother, you know, all I want, like yourself there with your own young son and your family, is a better life for me children.
Yeah, indeed. How have you been received by fellow politicians? You know, because you are an appointee, you were nominated by... Was it Micheál Martin at the time? He was the Taoiseach at the time. You were nominated by him. It was off the back of the advocacy work that you do. But not everyone in the Seanad is elected. But you weren't elected, and people might point out that you were elected for particular reasons. Whether that is true or false, I would say it's false. Did you have any pushback from politicians on your appointment and in the work that you're doing?
I got 76 first preference votes. I came in at number 6 and the panel of 11, there were 22 candidates and the same panel. So, like, considering I did extremely well, you know, I did get the nominee from Micheál Martin. And to be fair, Greg, I had one negative experience where a senator said I was a token seat and I fit all of the tokenistic, like, you know, I was a woman, I was a member of the traveller community, like someone from a minority group. And I had to get up and get on with that because, you know, I'm not that full of my own importance. I get on really well. Now, there is some people that would kind of not even speak to you. Do you know what I mean? And I say hello to absolutely everybody on the corridor. I try my best with people. I haven't had any negative experience with Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil, Sinn Féin, and Labour at a personal level, you know, when you're on the corridor, when you're having something to eat. And I just get on because at the end of the day, if we want change, we're going to have to be civil, whatever civilized is, and to get on with people and get to know people as well at a human level. You know, like I would get on pretty good along with the county council, along with the county councillors in Donegal, Niall Blaney. I'd get on really well with TDs as well, and that's Sinn Féin, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. Like, so I actually met John McHugh's mum and dad yesterday here, and it was lovely to have that, you know, like him making the effort to introduce me to his mother and father was nice. And you know, I work with Thomas Pringle, myself and Thomas work really well together. You know, we do a lot of campaigning together, and we just fish, like me and Thomas just make a good team, and there's only two of us, you know, but we great team behind us and what us too. So, like, you know, I couldn't ask for a better team, and the majority of my team are from Donegal. So yeah.
Well, what happens next as a nominee at the end of this Seanad term? Pardon my ignorance, Eileen, but if I don't know the answer to the question, I don't like to pretend. I'll just ask it straight out. So what happens next?
And when 90 days after the Dáil is finished and has to be going for re-election for the new term, we finish. And that's it. That's my term done. So basically, it's up to me. It's a personal choice if I want to go to be on a panel again and go around canvassing county councillors to vote me in. I don't know if you'd be lucky enough to get the Taoiseach's nominee twice. I don't know, and I wouldn't put my hopes on it. Just like the first time around, I wasn't hoping that I would get in that way. I tried very hard to get it on my own. But if I was to go again, I would like to get it by the support of the people who can vote for me. But we have to look at reforming the Shannon, where ordinary people can vote for the Shannon as well.
Yeah, but when you haven't decided yet whether or not you're going to seek re-election to the Shannon then?
No, and the reason why, Greg, is not until 2025. Now, see, today, like, I'm missing my children. I have to. I'm going to Cork tomorrow. Now, they're brilliant events, absolutely fantastic. And I could just be bad mood and say, no, I wouldn't run. And then tomorrow, everything could be hunky-dory. And you're like, oh, God, Billy's getting older. They're getting much bigger. Maybe I will run. Do you know what I mean? So I'm in that predicament of, you know, if I at least I'm privileged to have the opportunity. If I want to run, I can do it. And I will say I've built up great relationships along with deputies. And as I said, like, you know, myself and Thomas, we work really, really well together. So it's good to have that network as well and have that relationship.
All right. Well, there is Dáil elections coming up, European elections as well, and there's an extra seat in this part of the world. Could you see yourself perhaps running for the Dáil or for Europe?
Once I was going to run for Europe, actually, and I was in Donegal at the time, but, you know, I was approached by a party and I think that was setting me up to fail. Now, this is going back, like, you know, obviously I was much younger at the time. And I was like, no, around the general elections, I'm going to support, if he decides to run, Thomas to go in the generals. And I wouldn't put myself forward, most definitely not. And I think Donegal people are very like, traveller community, actually, and a lot of your listeners might laugh at that, because, you know, Donegal people do vote for their own, and I respect that. So I wouldn't run for the general elections in Donegal. No, maybe in 10 or 15 years, maybe something, if I was still alive and well, whatever, maybe something to think about. But, you know, why fix something if it isn't broken? I genuinely believe, and not because I have a good personal relationship with him, but I believe Thomas is doing a really good job, and I'm great to be able to support him, like I've supported many people.
But what if his machine were to get behind you for a run at Europe? Is that something that sounds a little bit more interesting to you then at this time?
No, you know, because Donegal is home for the girls, and it's tough enough coming up. It's probably would be easier actually to go to Europe.
Certainly than it is to Cork anyway. You definitely. Well, I spoke to a few MEPs when we were over there recently, and it seems like even if you don't have a family like you having responsibilities, it seems like a glamorous lifestyle, but it's not really. And a lot of them have to live outside Brussels itself because of accommodation. There's an awful lot of travel and an awful lot of lonelinesses too once the doors locked of an evening, which I got my eyes opened a little bit to that life. Finally, before you let you go, Eileen, we're talking about the struggles that you're experiencing and all other politicians, I think Dublin-based from rural areas, would, having to split family and work. I think it is. I think it's great to be honest and say I think it's definitely more difficult for women. But that's because the way we do it at the moment. And even if you were in the council, Eileen, you would be days, 2 or 3 days a week that you would see. They'd probably be in bed by the time you got home. You spend a lot of time in Dublin that you probably don't actually need to be there if we looked at things a different way. Why is there no push on to sort of try and blend things a little bit so people can spend more time at home but still be productive?
Yes. You know, sometimes I joke and say, just move Leinster House to Donegal, you know, to be able to have the opportunity to talk at a local level and still be a senator or a deputy for many people. But, you know, Greg, like, they sit the 3 days a week. There's little or no supports from the Oireachtas and at a council level for childcare. you know? And like, I put Billy's name in for childcare in the Dáil going back like over the 3 years ago, and I still haven't got the call saying that she got a place or she didn't get a place. She as far as I know, she's still on the waiting list, and I haven't took her off the waiting list, even though my children has got a childminder, their auntie, and you know, they couldn't be what a better person. So like, you have to make services much better for, especially for women in politics, and as well parents in politics too, because our children are not, shouldn't be obstacles. Our children should be should be part of the progress and part of the journey as well. But again, like, we can be more productive from a local level. Mm. But again, that comes with reforming Shannon. It comes with getting more women from Donegal, from rural Ireland, to be in at a local level as well. And in my view is that, like, you know, 40% of the quota now in every single political party, while women make up 50% of the population. In my opinion, that's an insult. Do you know what I mean? So even by our political parties, we're still treated 10% less than what men are. And obviously, I think women should be supporting women. And again, like, we talk about women in politics, it's genuinely about getting the right women in politics, the women who are, you know, who do believe in human rights and equality. Because, you know, I work with women every day, and there is at least one woman in Leinster House that, you know, that I wouldn't see would be very women equality friendly, funny enough. And we don't need people like that in our political system at a local level or at a national level. Maternity leave for county councillors as well. And I will say, like, county councillors are on crap money for the work that they have to do, and that needs to be looked at as well. Like, they do need to look at giving county councillors more power too, because it's a local authority. You're going into a system, there's only so much you can do when you're a local councillor as well, and people don't understand that, because county councillors have little or no powers, and also on a very very poor wages as well. So that all needs to change.
Mm. Yeah, indeed. And how many great people are we missing in positions of power because they've had to make a decision over being a parent or a family person and a politician? I mean, finally, how did that whole story with your taxi experience finish in the end? Did you speak to the taxi driver subsequently, or was anything clarified, or what happened after that, Eileen?
No, I just told the story. I haven't heard from them, Greg, to be honest. As I said, one part of me, like, would sit back and regret it because the amount of hassle I got from it, and I do get fair as well. But you know, if you compare me to another senator in the House, not one of them have to have that kind of experience, you know. And I think it's important that we share that. And like, my life is not a struggle, if you want, you know what I mean. Like, I love my life. I have a great partner. I have a lovely two children. My husband is really good, and you know, I just get up and get on with it. But some days it is really tough when you have to keep leaving the kids and stuff. But they do know it's a better future for them too. So, yeah.
All right. Thanks for all your time today, Eileen. Enjoy your trip to Cork, and hopefully you get back safe and sound for Friday. Take care of yourself. Bye-bye. Okay, that's Senator Eileen Flynn. Just getting insight into her life, and we might focus on another politician down the line just to have a chat and see what life is like for them. 086 60 25000. We are going to be talking history soon with Dr. Joe. It's always a really popular item on the programme, and we're going to be talking about the famine, because a very important anniversary is upon us. So any questions or comments with Dr. Joe, of course, get in touch. Time to talk history with our historian in residence, Dr. Joe Kelly. Joe, good morning to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
My Jean White, Greg, the chain that goes the Loch Deistiad. Good morning to yourself and to your listeners there in Highland Radio.
All right, okay. Now, last Sunday marked the 175th national commemoration of the famine, which was held in Milford. We had President Michael D. Higgins and Minister Jack Chambers and our own Cathaoirleach, Liam Blaney, in attendance. And good time now for us to discuss the famine. Before I get into it, I'm going to start with a big one here. We talk about it.
Easy on.
Yeah, no, but we call it a famine, right? Yeah. And you know, we have a modern sense of what a famine is, and a description of it. It's where crops fail. It's where, you know, there's nothing to eat. There's no rain. There's no growth in the land. But there was food in Ireland, and that food was taken from the Irish and exported. I'm not sure, and you can tell me, to a point whereby that was one of the main reasons why people were starving. But was it, how do you define it, Joe, with your background?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And maybe with the way we're going with Ireland and the peace process, it's probably a very politically sensitive matter as well. And it's very interesting that Tony Blair, 25 years ago, during the Good Friday Agreement, when things were trying to be bedded down, apologised to the nation of Ireland for the neglect of the famine by the British government. See, one needs to remember that in 1801, the Act of Union, so the famine was 1840, the worst year was 1847. So some four decades after the Act of Union, when we lost our own government, we were really British in that sense. So it was a British famine as opposed to an Irish famine. And we didn't have a government. And so we were controlled by Westminster. And they did some very positive things, but not enough. And I think the famine, the policy that England had led to our famine to some degree. And what people maybe don't understand is that England had gone through an industrial revolution and there was an urbanisation of England. And the policy in England then by Westminster was that Ireland would become the breadbasket for England to feed it with its agriculture. So Ireland wasn't to be developed with industry. And in that way, we were hamstrung by British policy, which was to their own benefit and not to ours. And so there is that question. And Cecil Woodham Smith, she wrote a book, and she actually had said that she was one of the first, that it wasn't a famine, that it was actually a genocide, that it was neglect by the British government because they controlled us and their policies that led us to our...
Do you agree, or does the truth lie somewhere in between that claim and what we would know as a famine?
Well, it's very easy to judge again from sitting back here from the perspective of history and having more knowledge and understanding of what actually how it played out. But the reality is that they did do things. They did import grain. That was Peel's brimstone. Peel was the prime minister. And then during the middle of the famine, Lord Russell, he became the prime minister. He did bring in public works, building bridges, piers, roads. Many of those piers and roads are here in Donegal today that we use. They also set up soup kitchens. But their attitude was that you shouldn't get free food without having to give labour.
Okay, and we'll get on to that because that's where the workhouses come from. Yeah. And I'm interested in your assessment in that. But just finally on how we phrase it and how we view it, have we had or do we need a national conversation or something convened where we settle on that part of our history, even if that is politically controversial?
That'll be a very interesting question. I would be more interested in settling on what has the effect of the famine been on us, on our soul, on our psyche, on our understanding and who we are. I remember a number of people, but one woman, for example, from Fannett down in Kinnelaw, it was known as Nellie Veck, and her parents were alive during the famine. So my memory of the famine is within one generation of someone knowing people that grew up on the famine. And we're all about five or six generations in real terms away from the famine. Historically, 175 years ago now, saying that someone is 50, that means it's 125 years away. In that sense, it is not, 150 years away. It is not a very long distance historically, but it has impacted on our soul. And back to the thing, and I have to be very careful about England. Daniel O'Connell wanted home rule, and one of his biggest opponents was Isaac Butt, who was an Orange man, who was a Protestant, who was of landed gentry, and who was totally opposed to him. And Daniel O'Connell said to him, someday you're going to jump across to my side and you will be arguing for home rule. And actually he did. Isaac Butt, who became the father of Irish nationalism and home rule, he changed his mind after the famine. As an Orange man, as a Protestant, he realised that England were interfering in the normal economics and social development of Ireland. And he realised that we needed our own government. And this is back maybe to understanding our history and how England will always serve its own interests first. And we have always suffered because of that. And so when you talk about the famine and do we need to have a conversation, I think we need to talk about our own self-worth and our own self-understanding of what happened to us. The impact on the famine in Ireland, right away, a million people died, a million people left the country. The Irish language was the beginning of the decay or the decline of the Irish language. It was the beginning of a lot of diaspora, a lot of effects of the famine. But here's what it really did. It robbed us of our poets or fiddlers or Shanachie. It robbed us of cleaned out lots of the older generation.
Do you know what that reminds me a little bit of? And it's completely different, and I'm not equating this with anything, but just in terms of how culturally you can lose so much. I was in I can't remember which one it was, a German city, knock with doing flights to it or whatever. I went over there. And just speaking to tour guides and talking to people, and because of Nazi Germany, and because of wanting to forget the past, and this is for different reasons, of course, anything that was even remotely associated with or could be Nazi Germany was wiped, you know, be it architecture, but also songs, pieces of music, writings, drawings, nothing, tons and tons of stuff that wasn't actually directly to do with Nazi Germany or Hitler in itself. A massive swathe of two or three generations of art and culture or what have you gone, and it's kind of, and there is some attempts to try and weed all that out and bring some of it past, but it was erased from German history for understandable reasons, and the same happened here from a different reason because of a natural disaster. You know, how much was lost?
Oh, I think it's going to take us, and I've said this before, we've had 800 years of colonialism. And in at the end of that period of colonialism, we had a famine that basically wiped out the natural people that would pass on tradition. Tradition in Latin, traditio, to hand on. So the language, the music, the folklore, all these people that had died, those people that would have all that story, all that history. When we came out of the famine, we were battered and bruised psychologically, socially, spiritually, and it played a big lot on our soul and our psyche, so much so that I think that, you know, our housing crisis today and different issues that we have today, everybody wants to own their house because somewhere in our psyche we didn't have. People are very generous in Ireland. We'd never want to see anybody without. And we're very generous for trochra and collections and when we hear of famines in other countries, because we know deep down in our own psyche, we were once that downtrodden, broken people.
So whether we're aware of it, like, you know, we don't all have the awareness, we can't help, but that is what's been handed down in the only two, three, four, five short generations past. That hangover, that shadow still affects us, even if we don't have the awareness to understand that that might be why we are the way we are in certain ways.
And I think that's got to do with part of our lack of confidence in ourselves, lack of belief in ourselves. And, you know, the politicians of that time let us down, and we knew that. And maybe we're still like that, thinking like that, that politicians should have let us down, where we should be expecting higher standards from those that are appointed to make our country a better country. And that's not a criticism at anybody.
No, it's a conversation on the people. It's not. I know you're not referencing the politicians, but look, the time is just going to go so quick. So I just, like, presumably there'd been failures of potato in the past. Did they lead to famine, death, disease previously? Obviously not on the 1847 scale, that being the worst year, but it must have happened in the past, of course.
Yes, famine was regular in Ireland. I mean, in my own parish in 1839, there was a severe famine, and the priest in Gador, for example, Father Doherty, had written about this famine that 9/10 of the population were starving. Famines were regular. There were a number of famines in 1850. And in fact, I would argue as a historian, the 1880 famine that was in Donegal was possibly worse than the 1847 famine. So when we think of the famine, we think of it nationally. But for example, during that time in the 1880s, 34,000 people in Donegal were on food lists. There was such a bad famine in 1880, but maybe that's for another day talking. So famines were a regular occurrence. And see, what basically happened was, with an industrialisation of England and the need for more food, etc., etc., Ireland had a system of dividing, subdividing the land, and the population was growing, growing about a million every 10 years. That's an amazing growth rate in the 1800s. So when we get to the famine, Irish population is growing 1 million every 10 years. And this is down to the simple potato, the lumper. You didn't need a lot of land, and you could produce a lot of spuds and feed your family. And what people maybe don't realise, the spud itself is a superfood. It's an amazing food. It is more potassium than a banana. I mean, if you lived on a diet of spuds, you will be actually very, very healthy. It prevents cancer. It helps strengthen bones. It relieves stress. It has vitamin C, vitamin B6. It has sodium, you know, to help you keep you from cholesterol. It's cholesterol free. You know. It's an amazing food. So this superfood was the diet for they estimate about 4.5 million people in Ireland at that time. And so when the blight came in 1846. They didn't have this fallback food. This was what they were living on. You know, the blight hit other parts of Europe as well, but they were not as dependent on the potato.
They diversified to some extent, whereas we were very reliant upon it.
And that led then just basically to the perfect storm. So how now were we going to feed ourselves? And the reality is that food, and this is what various historians have proven and shown, wheat and corn were still being exported from Ireland during the famine. Mm. It's hard to believe that, but food was exported from Ireland during
the
famine.
But who was making that decision? Because someone had to make a decision, because every action has a reaction. There's consequences for all the action. Someone or a group of people must have said, we are taking this food and it will lead to the starvation and death of hundreds of thousands of people, and it ended up being in the millions, not to mention forcing us to scatter around the world to try and seek out some. And I think sometimes we need to remember that element of our history, that we fled this country and we landed in other countries with nothing, and we weren't safe at home. We landed in countries at nothing, and to a great extent the doors were opened for us and we were allowed to make lives there, and we celebrate that now as a part of our history. But maybe all the roads come back to you not wanting to criticise the English, and if that's the case, I get that, right? But we were thrown under the bus to some. Someone had to decide to say, right, this, we are going to continue to make the money from exporting this food from Ireland, and that means people will starve as a result.
Well, you see, it was the kind of the prevalent economic philosophy at the time, not just in England, but in France and in other parts of Europe. It was called laissez-faire, laissez-aller. In other words, let things be the way they are, and water kind of finds its own level. So if there's poverty, leave it the way it is, and people will have to work their way out of poverty. If there's people making money, leave it the way it is and let them make money. I mean, if you go back into the 80s with Margaret Thatcher, she talked about there's no such thing as society. It was only the individual, and you must support the individual to become very wealthy. She broke the unions. So that was a philosophy that people had, that if you were poor, if you were hungry, it was your own fault.
Well, Joe, are you up to your ears, or can you come back after 11 for 10 minutes? Before I go, why did we not grow carrots and turnips and catch fish and eat that? And I'm not being facetious, right? But, you know, our lakes and rivers and seas are plentiful. There is, you know, could we not have grown other root vegetables, red vegetables, and eaten fish or meat?
Well, there's a few answers to that. Number one is those other foods wouldn't have given you what the spud would have given you to feed your family. That's the first thing. Secondly was farm husbandry, your farming methods, they wouldn't have had the knowledge or the technology, right, or the know-how and the availability for them. It wasn't what they were used to. And when you mention fishing, like the population in Torrey Island and Donegal increased during the famine because they had fish, and that
get
probably
you. I get you. Most it was like people, a lifeboat, effectively, then.
Yeah, but most people in Donegal didn't know how to fish, didn't have boats to fish.
I get you.
So, I mean, asking them to fish when they didn't know how to, or didn't have the equipment to fish, and didn't have boats. So therefore, you know, there was that problem of how you transfer from being dependent on a potato to other types of food.
All right, now, I hope that question didn't come across as insensitive, but I think sometimes it's best just to ask, because I'm sure there's kids of 8 or 9 years of age have put the hand up in class and asked the exact same question. Right, Dr. Joe Kelly's going to stay with us. We are going to take a break and then the news, and then we've got some questions that we want to run through with him. So stay right where you are. Joe, thanks very much for the time. You've time to grab a cup of tea. Back in about 2 minutes with the news.